want to again welcome everybody here this morning. If there's any visitors, we appreciate your presence and welcome the new members. Good to see the congregation growing a bit. This morning we're going to be looking at the faith of Daniel. There are several kinds of faith that are mentioned in the scriptures, from a dead faith, according to James, a little faith, a great faith, and there's a faith that, you know, even Jesus described, if it was just the size of a grain of mustard seed, you could move mountains with it. Some of the individuals in the New Testament and the Old have displayed that kind of faith, and Daniel is one of them. As we get into this, God's people are most often in the minority. Therefore, a vital trust in God is something that's needed in this world. In fact, the only times that God's people weren't in the minority is when Adam and Eve were created, and then immediately after the flood. And since then, again, you have to picture yourself as pretty much a minority in this life. God's people are in the minority because they are different. Different is the source of the word for agios, holy. When one is holy to God, when one is holy like God, one is different than all the rest of the world. And that should mark the people of God. So they are called different. The value of Christianity lies in its distinctiveness. Daniel's convictions were founded upon the law that God had given to his people. That's what made his faith distinct. It was according to God's word, according to God's law, according to Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14. Daniel was determined to hold to what God had said. To Daniel, there was an absolute right and wrong, not shades of gray like the world likes to picture it. It did not matter where he was or whom he was with, he was going to abide by the teachings of God no matter what. It becomes a good example for us, especially in this world. Our world is getting as bad as Daniel's was. We're going to have to look at that for a moment. The times of Daniel was a severely trying one to the faith of the average Hebrew. Primarily, they weren't in their home anymore. Daniel, at a very young age, was taken into captivity. He was growing up in a culture that he was not familiar with, a language he had to learn or relearn, customs that were altogether almost against what he grew up with. In fact, as we are introduced to Daniel as a young person at the beginning of his book, he's already having to refuse to eat the food that the Babylonians are giving him. When Babylon had conquered Judah, they were all now in captivity, and there's questions that begin to arise. Was the gods of Babylon stronger than the gods of Israel? Or the God of Israel? That must have weighed on a lot of the Hebrews' minds. Daniel, however, overcame awesome difficulties and succeeded where many lesser men would have failed. Daniel succeeded not merely because he had talent and drive, because he was foremost a man of God. He is also numbered among God's righteous ones. In a study of the Old Testament, one runs across the history of Abraham and his trying to, you know, save the city where his nephew Lot was. And he finally kind of dickered with God in order to get it down to five righteous people. If you'd find five righteous people in all of Sodom, will you spare the city? And God said he would. Unfortunately, he couldn't. But we get from this that if the righteous are there, then something will be spared. But this passage brings out something different, something we have to be aware of in a nation, in a city, or in a church. Just because some are righteous doesn't mean that the church might survive, or a city might survive, or a nation might survive. Further examples we have of that is in the seven churches of Asia. There were some good people in the seven churches, but only two of them were found acceptable to God. The others, if they didn't deal with the problems among them, God was going to remove their candlestick or their recognition as a church. In fact, Ezekiel 14:14 talks about how bad Jerusalem had become. And so he states this, even if these three men, and notice Daniel is numbered one of the three, Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, not the city. Daniel knew that it was not the people or the times that would spare him. It was his own conduct before the Almighty. And that's something for all of us to remember. No matter what the times are, the customs are, the city, the nation, whatever, we need to think foremost of what is the way we behave before our God. In Daniel 6:4-5, Daniel at this time, he's a little bit later on in his life. In fact, he's at the latter part of it. He's no longer in Babylonian captivity. He is now part of the Persian captivity and still in charge. In fact, he's kind of moved up. The Persian Empire is far greater than the Babylonian Empire was. In fact, it went beyond the comprehension of even Alexander the Great. Cyrus had put together a coalition of nations and customs and whatever peoples that were all loyal to him. And he had to keep in contact with it. In fact, it's recorded the first Pony Express system was active in the Persian Empire in order to keep the whole realm tied together and to know what was going on. Daniel was the head of all of that. The Persians had recognized the kind of character he was, the kind of ability they had, and they took him out of Babylonian captivity and set him over their government. Now, of course, when you've got that many people, there are all sorts of people under you vying for your position, one way or another. This is what we find here in Daniel 6. The governors, the satraps, sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, faithful to his God, faithful to his charge. They couldn't find anything wrong with the way he kept business or his ethical use of things. Nor could, it says, could they find any problem with him. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. And this is a period we're moving into in this country if it doesn't turn around. For being a Christian, eventually you're going to be doing something that's unlawful. And you may be charged for it. You may go to prison for it. You're going to find yourself pretty much in the same position that Daniel is. So we need, in order to sustain ourselves, to look at the faith that Daniel had. Daniel, first of all, in his faith, what we have to recognize is not just a belief in God. A proper kind of faith begins to produce other things. One of those was success. Daniel relied on an authentic trust in God. Daniel's commitment to God was sacrificial, not superficial. That is, he just didn't claim to believe in God. His life was dedicated to it, to trusting in God and sacrificing things in order to serve his God. He acted on the basis of deep faith and genuine commitment. He showed a real dependence on God. Notice in Daniel 6, 4-5, we just got through looking at, in verse 23, there's a phenomenal thing that happens. Okay, in that interim between verse 5 and verse 23, Daniel has been charged, indicted, and put into a lion's den. Now, the character of Daniel is such that even Darius, the head of the Persians, Medo-Persians, was concerned about Daniel's safety. He got trapped in a law that he put out there and didn't realize his friend was going to be caught up in it. But he had a faith in Daniel's God because Daniel had a faith in him. And so when the time period was up, we find him in verse 23 running out to the pit or the den to see if Daniel was still alive and his God had served him. And he finds out he has. Daniel's faith was real. He knew the God of the book, as well as the book of God. His heart, as well as his head, was involved in his faith. His faith and prayer life were linked in a vital way. In Daniel 6:10, we have a man over 90 years old acting on the basis of lifelong habits. No momentary impulses. Notice, now when Daniel knew that the decree had been signed, a decree that was hostile to him, we're going to look at it in a moment, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees, as he always had prayed, and gave thanks to God. He was just now under a murder sentence, and in his prayer is still his thankfulness to God. That's strong faith. Part of our prayer always has to be thankfulness to God, no matter what the circumstances are. Faith cannot be turned on in an emergency unless there is a reservoir to draw from, and that's what Daniel had. His faith was solid. He put faith in his God so many times that it was a done deal. He knew he could depend on God. It wasn't something like a lot of us where we say we believe in God, but we don't really pray to him. We don't really thank him for the daily things he does for us. But when a crisis comes up, we go to him in prayer and think that we can commit ourselves to it. Unless you've been constantly doing that, it's going to be very shallow. With Daniel, as with Abraham and others, faith was a principle of life. That is, trusting God was a principle of life. Had Daniel habitually allowed lesser things to interfere with his praying, it is most unlikely that he could have stood his ground when a death sentence threatened to intervene. But he went on doing what he always did, with his windows open so that anybody could see, and praying three times a day to his God. Daniel's situation illustrates why it's important for parents to impart good attributes and habits to children from infancy. We do not know what tests of faith our children will have to face later in life, but not to teach them regular habits in praying, Bible study, etc., that is, in making sound judgments, in standing by their principles, they got to be trained to do that. So as they reach into adult life, they do it instinctively, habitually, turning to God for help. If we don't do this, it will rob them of an advantage of being accustomed to doing what is right. Also with faith, proper faith comes courage. Daniel had moral as well as physical courage. In Revelation 21, John tells us that what God is looking for are people that are not afraid. In fact, he says, the cowardly shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone. Paul wrote to Timothy that God has given us a spirit of timidity. That is, God expects you to stand your ground and to stand for your faith. He expects it. Remarkably, Daniel stood alone. No visible means of help to bolster him. No parents that we can read of, no friends that accompany him, no one else that had his shared faith in the position that he held. Daniel understood that God is all that is needed. The next phrase should be memorized. It's vitally important for your prayer life, your Christianity. We may never know that God is all we need until God is all we have. And that's what Daniel understood. When it got to the point where God was the only thing he had, he understood that God was the only thing he needed. In 2 Corinthians 12, Paul came to that same realization. In fact, he says in his communication with God, he said, God said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Paul takes up that thought. Therefore, most gladly, I would rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ might rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, I am strong. Why? Because God is with him. God works through his infirmities, through his weaknesses. when we understand that we're not, we couldn't possibly take on the things we need to as a Christian all by ourselves and realize it's really just God working through us, great things will happen. Dare to be a Daniel and dare to stand alone. Dare to have a firm purpose and dare to make it known. Whatever the danger, we need to be able to say with Paul, none of these things move me. From Acts 20, what the circumstance is Paul has just been told that he's going to go bound to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, he's going to run into persecution and tribulations. And it was an effort by his friends to kind of dissuade him, even by the prophet Agabus. But Paul said, King James Version, none of these things move me. He determined to go to Jerusalem, and any kind of problems along the way, he didn't care about. They weren't going to deter him from doing what he felt was the right thing to do. Proper faith also makes us decisive. Faced with important choices, Daniel chose for God rather than wasting time trying to figure a way to make it happen both ways. James warns us about being two-souled or double-minded. You can't go with the world and go with God. Daniel didn't have that problem. When things arose, he made decisions immediately to do what was right. His obedience was prompt. Understanding can wait. Obedience cannot. When our duty is clear, action should be immediate to do the right thing. Just because God told you to do it that way, you don't have to understand why it's the right thing to do. All you have to do is have a faith and trust in God that if God told you to do it, it's something you need to do. There are grave dangers in postponing the principles of conscience. Delayed obedience is often a sign of indifference. Do we believe that God is? Example here in 1 Kings 18 is a familiar one with Elijah taking on the priests of Baal. Story's familiar. It's kind of exciting. On the one hand, you have this false god that does nothing. I mean, his priests are all day cutting themselves, praying, screaming, whatever, calling upon their god to set fire to their sacrifice. And all day long, nothing happens. And then Elijah displays his faith and trust in God. His sacrifice, he douses with water again and again and again until it's just saturated in the sacrifice. The altar is saturated. The trench around it is filled with water. And then God comes and ignites his sacrifice. Laps up all the water, does everything. I mean, it's a phenomenal display of God being with him. Of God being the God of Israel and more powerful than any pagan god that anybody worships. And you think that's all that's necessary. But Elijah turns to the people and goes, okay, if the Lord is God, follow him. And he gets nothing but silence. All these people that witness this uneven display of the power of God against the emptiness of idolatry, and they're still undecided. They can't make themselves committed to do the right thing. Faith, proper faith, also leads to integrity. Daniel had his priorities straight. Again, this looks like the same passage, but it just kind of starts the same. Okay, you've got the governors of the kingdom, the administrators, the satraps, the counselors and advisors. They all consult together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, they're petitioning Darius. Okay, let's have a statute. This is the decree that was hostile to Daniel. And he knows it's coming down. And the king doesn't realize what he's doing to Daniel. If anyone doesn't worship the king for 30 days and turns to somebody else, they're going into a den of lions. That's what their new law said. And because it's the law of the Persians, okay, now O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so it cannot be changed. We see this in the book of Esther, where Mordecai runs into this problem, where Xerxes at the time, or Artaxerxes, whoever it is, You know, he signs this decree, not realizing that he's putting his own queen to death. And that was the law of the Persians. Once it's signed, even the king can't retract it. And this is the setup against Daniel. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home and did what he normally did. He sat in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem. He knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God. Again, he prayed, he gave thanks, and even in his own death sentence. As was his custom since early days, he understood that even an unrighteous law is no excuse for unrighteous conduct. That's integrity. Daniel had great integrity. Integrity means the consistency between our convictions and our actions, our conduct. That is, in your conscience, if it's been trained by God and you know what's right and wrong, why do you hesitate to do the right thing? When you go by the code that God has written in your heart, that's integrity. When you forsake it, you've lost your integrity. Daniel's integrity contributed to respect for God and God's people. What a tragedy if he had cracked under the pressure, thus undoing in a moment what others had labored for lifetimes to build up. I mean, people knew of Abraham's integrity. The nations knew of it. Egypt learned of Joseph's integrity. The people of God. In most of the great nations of the time, Jewish men were put in positions of authority because they knew their rulers, whether it was the pharaohs, you know, King Nebuchadnezzar, or the Persian rulers. They knew they could trust the God of Abraham. They knew they could trust the people that served the God of Israel because they were trustworthy. They couldn't even trust their own people, but they could trust Joseph, they could trust Daniel. And if Daniel had turned on his integrity, all of that would have been wiped away. People would have lost faith in their God. But Daniel stood as a monument to what true faith was. That integrity with our God is something that the world is waiting for. I mean, that's why we see Darius running to the den of lions, you know, to verify it, to check it out. Daniel, has your God spared you? Daniel overcame his difficulties because integrity was founded on faith, trust in God. His depth and substance can surely be attributed to his regular daily contact with God. If you have a faith in God, how strong is it? Is it daily? Is it being fed daily? Is it being built up daily? Are you daily communicating with God? Are you daily reading the scriptures and listening to what God has to say to you? Are you daily putting him to the test to see that, yeah, God is going to show me the way, he's going to be behind good decisions? And we'll eventually, I mean, this is what Paul says, Romans, the 12th chapter, I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your reasonable service of worship. Be not conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, and prove, test out, what is the good, acceptable, and perfect will of God. This is what we do in our faith. This is why it grows, because the more we rely on God, the more he shows himself to be reliable. He had confidence in God because he had communicated with God. It's hard to trust a relationship if you're not in one. But Daniel was in a solid relationship with his God. Okay? And this is why his trust in God was solid. Daniel's trust in God shows that faith is the victory. This is what John tells us. Daniel was extremely grounded doctrinally. The pressures of his peers, the threats of the kings, and even the fear of death could not move him from the stand for which was right. Party note. How strong is your faith? If you were about to go into a den of lions, would you still trust in God? Would you even go down on your knees and pray to God and say, thank you for what's about to happen? Or even wait to see in this perceived end of things, perhaps God's got something planned to make a new beginning. In 2 Corinthians, the first chapter, long toward the end of it, when Paul is trying to convince the Corinthians that God is the God of comfort. I mean, he just goes over and over, just all the ways that God has comforted him. And then he brings up an example of something that we don't know anything about. There's no record of the incident or whatever, but he has said he and Timothy were at death's door. They had given up all hope of surviving the incident. But God turned it around and made it work for them. We should have that kind of faith, that kind of trust in God. We're about to sing Bring God Your Broken Life. When we start off by saying our conversion to God begins with faith, it begins with a trust. Are we committing ourselves to Him? The first show of that is baptism. We're literally saying, I'm willing to be buried alive because I trust God to raise me from the dead. That's what baptism is. And in that baptism, the old man of sin is washed away. And we are raised with Christ to walk in a new life. And this is why we need to keep listening to God, keep reading the scriptures, because God will now begin to direct our lives and make them grow and strengthen them. If they are broken, He can fix them. If we're weary in well-doing, He can give us strength. I think as Isaiah said, we can mount up on wings of eagles. We can face any challenge, but you have to have the right faith, the kind of faith that Daniel had, in order to put yourself out there. So the invitation is extended. We kind of get into a habit of going, okay, we're going to sing a invitation song and you come forward. The invitation is always extended. I mean, you can think about it for a little while. You know, whenever you're ready, all we're trying to do is, if you're fired up now, now's the best time to acknowledge God's invitation. We're here to help anytime. You want to change your life, you want to enter into a conversion that changes you to become a different person. God's word can help. Mm-hmm. Would you come, please?